Hey. What's the problem?
What?
With the car. What's the problem?
Just get out of my fucking face. Who are you?
We're stealing the fucking car. What's it to you?
It's my car.
Now you're gonna die.
Hey everyone, and welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Part 3 Podcast, your one and only source for all things about movies that came after two other movies. I'm Sam.
And I am Will.
And we are talking about a Part 3 from the gritty, crime-filled streets of New York by way of the ultimate schlock producers of the 1980s. We're talking about Canon Films, Golan and Globus's Death Wish 3. We're wading into the murky waters of Canon Pictures, and we may never make it out again. But we're starting off, yes, with Death Wish 3, starring the one, the only Charles Bronson.
Just being an affable older man walking around murdering minorities.
It's so weird because it gets the designation of that he's murdering minorities, but like both him and his apartment dwellers are very diverse, and the gang is also probably unrealistically diverse. The main villain is also a white guy, so
maybe minorities might not be the underclass, I guess, is probably the better way to phrase it. It's more of a class thing going on than a race thing.
I mean, it is so of its time. All right, so the original Death Wish is from 1974, and isn't from Canon Films, and is not from Golan and Globus. It's directed by Michael Winner, who directed this one as well. And it was it's the ultimate vigilante story. Mild-mannered, middle-aged man, lives in Manhattan, and one day his wife and his daughter are mugged, and they are brutally beaten, the wife is killed, and
the daughter's sexually assaulted,
yes,
right?
Yes, of course. We're right off the bat, we will say there's gratuitous rape in all of these movies, perhaps not always for narrative purposes. A man who was at one point a conscientious objector suddenly becomes a vigilante and is killing muggers on the streets of New York, and the cops are after him. But perhaps the cops don't want to catch him that bad, because maybe he's finally standing up for what's right as in crime-ridden New York City of the 70s and then the 80s. It's the movie that teed up later movies like Falling Down and the Boondock Saints. It's based off a novel that is ostensibly condemning vigilantism, and the author was not a fan of the movie. But it's this movie and Death Wish 2 were produced by Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus, who in the 80s. Were the king schlock producers of Hollywood, and we've been adjacent to their work in the past, in that they produced Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 and Superman 4, but this was one of their, you know, this is a signature film from them, because, you know.
Well, they signed Charlie Bronson, and that was sort of a big get for them at the time. They started signing all these stars to become sort of regular contract players for them, and Charlie Bronson was one of the first, right?
Yes, air quotes stars.
Right, I mean, Charles Bronson, whose star was falling, if not totally fallen by this point.
Charles Bronson is a character actor who, for, you know, you young folk, he's the kind of guy that's in the movies that our dads would say they don't make them like they used to about these. He's in The Great Escape. He's in The Magnificent Seven. He's in Once Upon a Time in the West. He has a career dating back to House of Wax, I think, was one of his earliest roles. And, you know, he's a very distinct-looking dude and, you know, a very, very solid character actor, always a badass in all the Westerns and war movies he was in. But I would say, you know, he's not on the level of a lot of other action heroes, even of the 80s, certainly not of the 80s, because he's
the original
movie, he's meant to be middle-aged and not like an overt action star.
Right.
And I think that's one of the problems the author had with the original movie, is that they cast Charles Bronson when you should expect an ordinary dude.
You want Richard Dreyfuss, you don't want Charles Bronson, exactly. Right? I mean, that's like, you want sort of an ordinary guy, and Charles Bronson has, like, all the baggage of being a badass cowboy for the most part.
Even when they put him in the mustache and the really bad rug. You know, he's just got access to all sorts of weapons that he gets off the dark web, as far as I can tell, But the first one, and to a slightly lesser extent the second one, still feel like they're real movies set in the real world. This movie is basically the MGM Studios Death Wish Stunt Spectacular, and it's set in the quintessential crime-ridden 80s New York, where it's just marauding gangs of toughs harassing anyone they lay their eyes on.
But not for real reason. It's like they're just like doing crime for the fun of it.
It's hilarious to them.
Just gibbering lunatics just attacking people, and like the way that this movie works is it basically seems like it's set within like four blocks.
Yeah, they specify this as a very specific little neighborhood, like uptown, and it's just this war zone run by this gang. The gang doesn't even have a name. They're referred to as creeps. Yeah. Like, you know, but that's just sort of like instead of hoods or gang members, they're creeps. I hate creeps. Mr. Kersey just shot one of the creeps. And they give off a real vibe like one of those gangs in The Warriors that doesn't get invited to
Cyrus's powwow.
And they're led by this guy, played by Gavin O'Herlihy, who we saw in Superman 3 as Lana Lang's drunk ex-boyfriend. But as you discovered, Will, and pointed out, he is the son of our patron saint, Dan O'Herlihy, Connell Cochran himself.
From Halloween 3.
So he's the official Nepo baby of podcast part 3, the part 3 podcast. But I actually will say he might give the best performance in the movie.
I think watching it this time,
you and I watched this for the first time. We rented it. I bought it on VHS at Amoeba. And
for like $2, right?
$2. And you brought your VCR over. You, me, and Daniel got really hammered, and we watched it, and it was a blast. Because it's 90 minutes long, it's dumb as hell, it's full of action. If you ignore the fact that it's pretty damn sleazy, and in real life the director was kind of a psychopath that no one has anything nice to say about, it's a pretty fun action watch. I would put it above most of the like Chuck Norris fare that came out of canon at the same time because it's sillier, it thinks it's smarter, but it's dumber, but it's also not boring. And that's the thing, I've never gotten on board with the canon Golden Globus Chuck Norris fare, is because it's all painfully boring to me.
Well, because a lot of the canon stuff is just so repetitive, and this movie has that problem too, but it's a little more like it's just dumber and sillier.
It's almost hilarious in how repetitive it is.
Right, exactly.
Because the whole middle act is just Charles Bronson basically coming up with different ways to bait these guys into doing crime so he can kill them. Like he buys the camera and is walking around like with the camera, like he's almost like trying to be all like sexy so he can lure the giggler to get him.
And right, and then the guy grabs it, and then he turns around and just shoots the guy. And it's just, and you're, so, but this movie definitely has the canon thing, which is also true of the Asylum movies as well, where it's like the story, they have a beginning and they have an end, and then in the middle it's just sort of either try fails, or in the case of this movie it's like try successes.
This movie feels like it's missing a layer of plot that explains the movie's existence. So in this one, he comes back to New York to visit his friend who lives in this bad neighborhood. And by the time he gets there, his friend has been killed by the gang members. And his dying wish is, will you take care of my shit for me now that I'm dead? Which is a weird request, but anyway, he does. But before he can get there, like before he can, you know, before that happens, he's pulled in by the cops, who initially think he's the killer. And the detective character played by Ed Lauder, Shrieker?
Yeah, Shrieker or Shrieker? I wasn't, I even watched this with subtitles and I wasn't quite clear on what the...
He's Shrieker. And Gavin O'Herlihy is, he's Shrieker, and the villain is Fraker.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, yes, yeah, so police chief Fraker, Shrieker, fuck. So basically, the cops, instead of arresting Charles Bronson for his many acts of vigilantism across the country, say, we're cutting you loose into this shitty neighborhood. And you can do what you want. You got to kill some guys, put some bodies down, that so we can claim them and make it look like we've been actually accomplishing something. Because the other message of this vigilante movie is that the cops are helpless, their hands are tied, and they're incompetent. And so it's like there's no good guys. There's just victims and incompetent fools. And murderers.
And the gibbering lunatics. Yeah, and I mean, you almost expect the movie to sort of go down this route where, you know, this attorney, this court-appointed attorney he gets, he, you know, he talks, he like, the, who has, he ends up sleeping with randomly, because they try to make Charles Bronson a sex symbol in the middle of this movie.
Yes. Hello. I like I will say, I like his look. Not the mustache and the ridiculous badger on his head, but I like his style. I like the jacket. I like his sport coats. You know, I like Paul Kersey's look.
It's pretty, it's, no, it is. It's,
he's, you know, he's no Clint Eastwood in terms of, like, action hero charm, but, you know.
But, like, you would expect the movie to go along this route where you know, his girlfriend finds out about his past and is like a vigilante and what he's doing, and you'd expect the girlfriend to go, oh my god, what have you done, and you sort of have like that moral quandary in part of the second act, right? Instead, she's like, no, my god, I wish I didn't have this job anymore. I have to defend these fucking creeps too. Someone has to do something. And then about two scenes later, she's punched in the face and her car blows up.
Yeah, she only exists to be a victim, like every woman in these movies, unfortunately. And then there's also, like, you'd think maybe they're going in a direction where the cops are corrupt.
Right,
and,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
No, but it's like, it's not quite copaganda, because the cops always come off pretty incompetent. Like by the end of the movie where the whole thing's devolved into just a war zone, the cops aren't exactly, it's the only man who can stop all of these criminals is Charles Bronson and his one gun in that same shot of him just shooting over and over again. You'd go down that road. You go down. Is the gang connected to something bigger? Is there some sort of corrupt bit? There's an element of, like, you get the sense that Fraker, the gang leader, is also, like, working with other people, because there's a moment where he just gets on the hotline and is like, I need to order some more dudes.
And all the gangs come in from
just
all
these
over.
Bikers show up, and it's like, what's his deal? Is he, like, I was, of course, like, sitting there, like, rewriting it and coming up with my own backstory of, like, he's actually a fucking, like, he's Donald Trump Jr., but he's, like, a sociopath, so he just is like, I'm gonna take over this gang and, like, ruin this neighborhood so we can develop it. Like, something like that. I don't know. It's like, it's missing something.
Well,
it's so hilariously simplistic.
Yeah,
like, for a movie that stems from an original movie that's supposed to have some nuance to
right.
it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, and the way that the movie sort of goes along is it starts becoming sort of more and more fascistic towards its, you know, its characters and everything.
It's almost more like anarchic.
Or like nihilistic too. It just seems like everyone except for Kersey, I guess everyone except in this one apartment building, like the six people that Kersey interacts with, are they're okay, but everyone else is either like hopelessly inept or, like you say, just a gibbering lunatic.
And it's the movie ends with him blowing up the bad guy with a bazooka, which is admittedly great.
Yeah.
Well, how more movies should end like that. I think that's not the first or last time he blows up a guy with a bazooka in this franchise, but the movie literally just ends. They blow up the bad guy and the other bad guys just go away.
Yep.
And he walks away down the street and never to be seen again. And that's the end of the movie. Yeah. There's like 30 seconds between the death of the bad guy and the credits rolling.
Yeah, it's so bizarre in that sense, but it's also like so canon, like a canon film too, because it's sort of just like, the movie's over, we're done, we don't need anything else. Denouement, what is this? It's over.
Yeah, when you think of, if you know anything about Golden Globus, if you think of their movies, this is the movie you're thinking of. Like,
yes.
it's they, you know, there's this great documentary called Electric Boogaloo, the story of canon films, because among their other movies, they did Breakin' and Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo. And it's Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus. Menachem was more the creative guy. He was like, he directed a lot. He, you know, they both came out of the Israeli film industry, came to L.A., were very much like these independent guys that wanted to make, they just cranked out movies, like one after the other. And it's, the problem is that they clearly were like not that interested in making, you know, being patient and making good movies. They just wanted, they were in love with the idea of being movie makers, but the nuts and bolts of it just didn't interest them.
No,
it's that thing where, you know, it's like they got a lot of heart but not a lot of talent, and they you know, the star that burns twice as bright burns half as long.
Well, I mean, I think it's, and you know, we both rewatched this documentary after for this episode, and a lot of the stuff reminded me of my time at the Asylum, where it was, it's just like, let's crank out as many movies as we can. And when I was at the Asylum, they were making 12 movies a year. And now I think they make like 36 movies a year or something like that.
And the Asylum movies often have like air quote, like names, like actors who are sort of past the prime of their career. If Martin Balsam was alive today, he'd be in Asylum movies.
Well, right, and the idea is that, you know, it's the same thing that Cannon did, is that they had a star that was bankable, unnamed, that could sell somewhere, and they'd have buyers, they have international buyers who just would buy it because that they know the name. It's the same, I mean, at least that's how the Asylum operated then. I'm sure it still operates in similar fashion now.
What was the undoing for Canon was that they started making bigger and bigger movies that still weren't profitable.
Right.
So it was like they gave Stallone some ungodly amount of money to, you know, make Over the Top, his arm wrestling movie. They, you know, they made like a huge budget Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel and then didn't market it properly. They made Superman 4.
And Masters of the Universe, too.
And all these movies, and they got bigger and bigger, and then they just, as we've talked about before, they had they went in their separate directions and made their Dueling Lumbata movies. That came out in the same weekend, because on top of everything else, they were both the pettiest bastards you've ever met.
Oh, man.
But this was the kind of movie they were comfortable making and could make.
And they could make fast and cheap, and they cranked out. I mean, you know, there are what, two other Death Wish sequels after this? Did they get up to five, or did it only get up to four?
It got up to five. I'm not sure if the fifth one is canon,
like, right,
made by canon. Two, three, and four absolutely are.
Right.
And like this one and two were directed by Michael Winner, who directed the original, and was like, as we've said, as Alex Winter and Marina Sirtis both say in the documentary, a truly heinous person to work with.
Yeah, it seems like a lunatic. I wrote down Alex Winter's quote, because he's in this movie, and movies are an unreal environment in the best of times, and the canon movies were like that times 100.
Yeah. I liked the guy that said that's what canon movies were. They always resembled something, minus good taste.
my favorite character in that documentary is the former head of MGM, who is so bitter. Because they made a distribution deal with MGM at one point. And
you've reneged on a deal. You've given us nothing but junk. They talk about all these movies they did with MGM, and then after one, they just cut to this guy. He's like, I mean, the problem was the movie was a piece of shit. Sahara was a piece of shit. Quartermain was a piece of shit.
And it's this head of MGM who makes this deal with Canon, this like a big, you know, deal to distribute their movies, and like every single one of them just bombed, and this guy just sounds so bitter, like 30 years later.
Well, they were a schlock machine, and that's not a bad thing.
No.
They did work, and they became like a haven for a lot of directors, and they did produce some really interesting films. Like, they did Runaway Train, they did Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, they did, you know, they worked with, yeah, they did Barfly, there's some interesting movies that came out of there, but like, it doesn't sound like it was the most enjoyable place to work. No. And it doesn't seem like they were very good at running the business. They didn't reach the box office and awards levels of the Weinsteins, though maybe they were comparably better people, but they're no Roger Corman, man.
No.
Like, that's your gold standard. Roger Corman is like,
well, and it,
how do you be a Roger Corman is what we should all aspire to be if we're going to be movie producers, because he's just like, or Lloyd Kaufman. For that matter.
Well, I think the thing about Corman that I think made him sort of a genius was that he at least could recognize talent, and at least my understanding is that he was just basically, if you can do your movie in this amount of time under this amount of money, you're good to go. And if you stretched out of those bounds, then he would step in. But like the Canon guys, and I'll put the Asylum on this too, it's not that they can't recognize talent, it's just they want their fingers in the pie. So they're always interfering with whatever's going on, you know?
Yeah, Corman knew to get out of the way. Well, I mean, also Corman was a relatively solid director himself. Like, right. He knew how to... The vision you have of all these producers is Mike Starr and Ed Wood, you know, George Weiss, you know, fuck, we don't have a script. We got a poster. It's like, fine, film whatever shit you want as long as it's six reels long. You know, like, but Corman bucks that stereotype because Corman is like the most genteel human being you've ever met. And everyone that talks about him, like all the guys that came out of the Corman camp, like Dante, Cameron, yeah. Ron Howard, Jack Nicholson, they all have nothing but lovely things to say about him.
Yeah.
That not so much the tone in Electric Boogaloo about Golan and Globus is more just, at best, sort of a, those guys, you know, sort of shaking your head like, it was a ride, you know, yeah. They were real ones, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and just the, you know, I don't want to get too far, I don't know how much there is to talk about Death Wish 3, but just the amount of stuff that they cranked out that was just like either like bananas or like just half baked. I mean, Sam, one day we will cover it. I don't think we can cover it soon because it's not like available for streaming, and I'd like something that's easily accessible for our audience to see, you know, should they want to. But Ninja 3, The Domination.
Well, yes.
Which is a third part to, which is... a part three in that it has the number 3 in the title, but is not technically a sequel.
Sort of an anthology series of ninja movies. Yes, that's it's Flashdance meets The Exorcist meets a ninja, movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, no, they would jump onto any trend that they could find and try to capitalize off of it, and it most of the time just didn't work because, you know, they were so, they couldn't they meddled with everything they did, and they weren't patient, and they didn't listen, and they didn't learn from their mistakes. And,
exactly.
You know, yeah. I think Death Wish was, you know, like, it's not good, no. But, like, they were, they the ninja movies and Death Wish and the Chuck Norris movies were, that was their wheelhouse, and that's what they should have stuck with. It was when they tried to, like, yeah, when they were like, well, here's the solution to us losing money. Let's finance a $30 million Masters of the Universe movie
right.
that visibly runs out of money midway through.
Yeah. Or you know, let's try and buy the rights to Captain America. Captain America movie?
Was
didn't
that
they?
Them? They don't I talk think, about they that don't in talk the about... documentary. Although the rubber ear Matt Salinger one.
Oh, so this was one of the ones they got in the split when Golan left canon in 1989.
Yes. Well, it's Albert Piyun had directed it, and he was a canon guy.
Yeah. And one day we'll get to some of Albert Piyun's movies, because he's got a lot of part threes in his filmography.
Oh, does so. He? They did, like movies like Life Force, Toby Hooper's Life Force, which is, you know, it's these insane films that they're ambitious, but it's not, like, from a business standpoint, they didn't have any of the right instincts about what to do past crank out action cheese.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, when they're doing their bread and butter, when they're doing sort of a ninja movie or a Chuck Norris actioner or a Death Wish movie, then, like, that's kind of, when they're in that lane, that's when they're most successful. When they're most successful in terms of money, not necessarily the movies are good.
Yeah, and Chuck Norris, they made a big star. Like, right. You know, he'd done stuff before canon, but, like, he was kind of their biggest IP.
Right.
You know, Bronson didn't really do much past the Death Wish movies at this point in his career. You know, his peak had come in the 60s and early 70s, obviously.
Yeah. God, you know, the gang in this movie, like, every, like, gang member that shows up, and it seems like every other scene has a new gang member. Like, it just is so fun. It almost becomes a parody of itself in how, like, just, like, it's like, okay, so here's a group of gang members. What are they going to get up to next?
They're like RoboCop gang members. It's like, this is like a less self-aware RoboCop, because it's like, there's no evil corporate, you know, gentrification subplot. But it is like all the gang members, like every one of them, there's the lead who's like menacing and in control, but he's also the most sadistic and violent. But then all of the other ones, just nothing amuses them more than when they get to commit crimes.
Exactly.
Like, Alex Winter is just so delighted to be a criminal.
My favorite kill in the movie is when the two guys are trying to steal Bronson's car.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes out, he's like, what's wrong with the car? And they're like,
hey, what are you guys doing? We're stealing the car. What does it look like?
It's like, well, it's my car. I just love the way that he delivers, well, it's my car.
And well, it's also like, you actually realize, like, he's had this whole, like, 10-minute progression that's just him positioning himself to shoot these guys. You see him buy the car, invite himself to dinner with the nice Jewish couple on the first floor, so he can eat, so he can have some boiled cabbage, so he can hear them breaking into the car. So he's like, oh, excuse me. And he goes outside and shoots them, and then comes back inside. It's like, I don't think I'm not giving the movie credit enough to say that there was, like, a bit of a sense of humor to that.
Yeah.
I think it's just like, we're just positioning ourselves to get to the point where we can have Charles Bronson shoot somebody. It's like,
exactly. Yeah.
Like, the movie's not, like, I can see points where you could lean into the cleverness or the dark comedy of it. But it's not. It's just, this movie thinks Charles Bronson shooting guys is awesome.
Yeah.
And we will do whatever we can to get him to that point.
To shoot guys, yeah.
Especially through scenarios where Charles Bronson doesn't have to do a lot of action stunts.
Right, where he just walks up to two guys who are... yeah, it's... It's a weird movie. I enjoyed it kind of right up until the Marina Sirtis scene.
Yeah.
And then kind of I turned on the movie.
Well,
because I had forgotten completely about that.
Well, they talk about, Marina Sirtis talks about, like, when they've had to film that scene, it was like she was made to lie in this, you know, topless in this disgusting basement, and it was cold, and like one of the guy, like the DP or someone tried to cover her up so she wouldn't get cold, and Michael Winner screamed at her, and like, you know, it's like, Jesus, you guys. It's like, I mean, he's dead now, so I can't talk to him, but I would just say, you're making Death Wish 3.
Yeah.
And even if you were, like, here's the thing, there's no excuse for Kubrick yelling at Shelley Duvall on the set of The Shining. I don't care who you are.
Yep.
You don't have to be like that. Don't do that. But, like, apparently, you know, this is just how some directors think they have to be, and it's absurd. And it's like, you know, thankfully Marina Sirtis, her best days were ahead of her in her career, because she was involved in a bunch of canon movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And usually in a bit of an exploitative way. It's great that she talks about it, because it's a window into a fascinating and gross period in Hollywood filmmaking. And this is also just like a fascinating and gross period in American culture, because it is this period of like crime ridden New York. You know, it's like someone's got to stand up to these, you know,
stand low, up to the scum,
the scum, these low rent, I don't know, late junior boomers, I guess. They're not even like Gen Xers. These 40-year-old hoodlums. I mean, it's a subgenre that's existed in some form or another from everything post-World War II.
Oh, yeah.
You had this stuff in the 50s. You had Blackboard Jungle. You had, you know, the drag racing movies. And then you had the stuff with the hippies in the late 60s. The 74 was still like just, when the first one came out, it's like hippie, like druggy muggers of the Manson. It was Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum was one of them. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and like, I love how also like there's just this pile of rubble constantly in the background that like never moved around.
It's the old, we had a neighborhood in some city that was going to get demolished anyway, and they said we could blow it up for them. You know,
exactly.
That's exactly what this is. Because it is just like, it is a war zone. It's, as a gang, there's no benefit to burning down your own turf. Like, if you've watched The Wire, Avon Barksdale does not want to burn down his corners, you know, in Baltimore. That's his business.
Yeah, I mean, and it just reminds me of, have you watched Rebel Moon yet?
I have not watched Rebel Moon.
I mean,
I've seen Star Wars.
Oh, well, have you seen, and you've seen The Magnificent Seven, right? So,
oh, yes, yeah. And The Seven Samurai, and A Bug's Life.
So there you go. But there's a moment where, like, the bad guys are, you know, they're on this planet, and they're getting all their gear together, and these two bad guys give some exposition about the robot that Anthony Hopkins plays.
Right.
And they're like, and one guy is like, see, they don't fight because of, you know, some lore explanation. And then the one bad guy goes, see, I'm going to show you. And he shoots the robot in the head with a laser gun, which doesn't hurt the robot, but makes the robot like drop all the supplies they're trying to unload. And it's like, dude, come on. You are trying to do something here. Like, you have an objective that you need to meet. Why are you shooting your fucking robot to pick up the boxes? it's just like these guys, it's like, obviously they're making these guys like evil, but there's a certain point where it's like evil becomes just so excessive in a movie where you're like, why are you, it's like counterintuitive to be evil now, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Well, but it's also like, what is, I mean, yes, I think there is something refreshing, especially in modern movies, when you have a villain who is just a villain, like
right.
Guardians of the Galaxy 3, the bad guy is unrepentantly evil, but he also has a goal. He's
right.
Not just going around doing just beating people up.
Right.
He has a goal. Like, this gang, even by gang standards, doesn't have a goal. Though every gang in the Warriors has a goal, you know, right. even beyond we got to find the warriors. It's, right. you know, they are, you know, they have their territories. They presumably deal drugs and beat up encroaching gangs, et cetera, et cetera. This gang appears to just want to burn down the world. Now, if that is their goal, it's not articulated.
Right.
It's not like the Joker in The Dark Knight, you know, right. it's it's just mayhem for mayhem's sake.
Right, and I don't want to say that like I want all my villains to, you know, be nuanced or be like or have complex emotions. I'm totally fine with bad guys being bad guys. I just think, or if this were like a post-apocalyptic world, like a Mad Max universe, I could sort of understand having gibbering lunatics just being gibbering lunatics because of the world has gone insane or whatever. But it's like here, it just adds to the cartoonish nature of this movie that these guys are just so, like, over-the-top evil and just for evil's sake.
Well, it's also, like, if you're making, and this, again, this is asking a lot of an action movie from 40 years ago from canon.
Right.
But typically when you have a franchise continue, you want to challenge the protagonist with things they haven't encountered before. So your movie can get more ambitious and more complicated or nuanced in terms of show him something he's never seen and have our hero have to react to it in some way. So what's the new angle on these villains? This is the dumbing down
right.
of what you see in Death Wish and Death Wish 2. This is the other version this is what franchises were for a long time with a few exceptions. It was just we water down the premise over and over and over, and some are going to work and some are not, but it's not progressing the character in a franchise. This is the anti part three,
right.
in that it's not it's defining what we all think of when we think of Death Wish, but it's honestly damaging the more interesting aspects of the franchise in that sense.
Right. I mean, like, 'cause you'd think like if there was a little more thought put into this, like you said earlier, you'd think that he would be dealing with corrupt cops or corrupt politicians and like having to sort of navigate being a vigilante and dealing with that sort of evil, not just sort of the gangs that are running the street. It's like, if this were made by Paul Verhoeven, that's probably how it would go, like RoboCop, where it's like everything is corrupt and there are layers to the society yeah. of the corruption and it trickles down.
You could even, yeah, if Frank Miller was doing the script, it would still, it would have all of those angles, maybe still yeah. complicated, but right. but the point is, yeah, like if you were, I didn't see the remake with Bruce Willis.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I don't know if it changes it at all. I don't think it does. I think it's, you know, Eli Roth, who generally I like Eli Roth's movies, but they're also much like Zack Snyder. There's the rule of cool kind of
reigns exactly. supreme,
and it makes the same mistake as the original in that if you're trying to do a movie about an ordinary guy who's pushed to this point, you don't cast John McClane. You cast I don't know, Paul Rudd. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's so funny because like what makes Die Hard work so well is that it's Bruce Willis and he seems like an ordinary guy, but by the time they made that Death Wish remake, Bruce Willis had made like 30 action movies.
Yeah, Bruce Willis was an action movie yeah. icon. It was yeah. it was not quite as it was at that point on the level of like if they cast Schwarzenegger in the part.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's like I had fun. I don't want to
no,
like
this movie,
I had fun with this movie.
Are looking for a piece of 80s action cheese, look no further. This like there's some problematic stuff in it that'll be a little bit that's kind of sleazy, and I think does in fact when I think about it affects my enjoyment of the movie.
Yeah.
But if you just want dumb action dumbness, like if that's what you want tonight, yeah, this movie's perfect for that. It's so quick.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't even think it cracks 90 minutes.
No, it's so quick and uninterested in like being thoughtful in any way, which is honestly like if you're not gonna try, don't try.
Exactly. Like, yeah, it is refreshing that it doesn't go in any of the subplots that you expect it to. It's just like, nope, all the bad guys are bad. And the only person who could do anything about it is Charlie Bronson.
And it moves. It's yeah. not boring. Like, the problem with Chuck Norris movies is they're so much downtime. Like, yeah. Him just sort of, like, his build up to an action moment is always so arduous to me. Like, I know a lot of people love Invasion USA, but that movie is so slow. Boring.
Well, and it's, you know, it's one of those things where, because it's not like an Arnold movie or even some of the lesser Stallone movies where Arnold's acting ability, limited as it may be, there is like a personality there where there's like a character. And Stallone is a good actor when he tries, and there's a character usually there. With Chuck Norris, he's Chuck Norris. And usually Chuck Norris movies, he never has to like, he doesn't have any problems. He's just sort of running around killing people. Like,
there's no, every single other 80s action guy, Stallone, Willis, Schwarzenegger, Charles Bronson even, you can point to some other movie in their career and say, oh, here, look what they are capable of. Look at Conan the Barbarian. Look at Rocky. Look at, you know, Charles Bronson was in action classics. Look at Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's what these guys can do. There's something back there. There's nothing with Norris.
No.
When you see 80s Norris, that's peak Norris. That's the best Norris can be, because he's not, he's just busy being Chuck Norris. The other one I would say is Seagal. I can't think of some like secret gem in Seagal's filmography.
Well, and honestly, I haven't seen enough to, I know people like Under Siege 2 a lot. I've never seen it, so I can't speak to it. And I've only seen the first one, but he's such a boring actor.
He's off-putting as a human being, but he's just like, everything about him is so strange to me.
Yeah, he's like, a weird dude.
Like, he's inhuman even by, like, muscle-bound action hero standards. Yeah. Like, he like, Van Damme and Lundgren come off, like, grounded compared to him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best Seagal movie, at least that I've seen, is Executive Decision, which just kills him off in the first 15 minutes.
It's like, oh, you thought, oh, guess what, gang? Guess what? We had a surprise for you. It's not a Steven Seagal movie.
It's a Kurt Russell movie!
Massive upgrade.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I don't know. It's as a part three, yeah, I guess it does define what this franchise is, because when people think of Death Wish, they're more inclined to think of this than anything else.
Right.
Or like, it's kind of like Rambo in that sense. It's like most people think of Rambo and don't think of First Blood.
No.
Like, First Blood is so different from those other movies. You think of Rambo 2, 3, 4, 5.
And, yeah, exactly.
I'd say this is similar to that, though. I don't know if any of these reach quite the highs of the best of the Rambo franchise.
No. Well, I mean, I don't... Did we watch Death Wish 4 in our booze-filled Death Wish marathon, or was it just this one?
I bought the VHS for Death Wish 4, and you and Daniel refused to watch it. you were drunk, and you were tired.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, so I haven't seen any of the other Death Wish movies. I think I caught a little bit of the original Death Wish on AMC once, years and years ago, but... So I can't speak to how this franchise turned out.
I think it's a lot of this.
It seems like it's just the same.
Well, I mean, I know the first two both end with much smaller scale climaxes.
Right.
You know, this is like, the end of this one is insane. It's like so many dummies falling off buildings, so many guys flipping over railings, and so many cars getting, like, old shit cars getting blown up. So, you know, it is iconic Golden Globus grade at 80s action schlock. And it's, you know, if you're looking for that, you found it. It's like, if we knew what we were getting going into this. It's both the best and the worst of Hollywood in the 80s on a certain level.
Yep. Yeah. I think that sums it up pretty well, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's, there's not much to say, but the movie doesn't have much to say.
Yeah. There's not a whole lot going on.
Except that shooting dudes is awesome.
Well, when Charles Bronson does it, it's awesome. And, like, everyone wants to fight Charles Bronson in this movie, which is also really... When he's in prison, everyone's, like, wanting to fight him for no reason.
Everyone looks at him and is just, like, just wants to jump him immediately.
Like, fuck that guy.
Like, what? I guess it's because he's supposed to be, like, this mild-mannered dude. Yeah, and, but at this point, it's like... And I guess if you were a huge Death Wish fan in the 80s and you went to see the movie, you're like, oh,
you're going to get it.
Oh, you're going to get it. He's going to bop you. He's going to flip you.
Oh, boy.
Well, with that in mind, Will, what is your Death Wish for next week?
Well, I am not ready to leave our friends at Golan Globus and Canon Film Enterprises.
Of course you're not. I knew once you were here, you'd never want to leave.
Yeah. So I'm going to go to a franchise that I don't know. So after watching this and watching the documentary, I watched the first part of this franchise, and I was delighted. It is so gloriously stupid and over the top. So we are going to do American Ninja 3.
I have no reaction, like most people would have no reaction. Those are the ones with Michael Dudikoff, right?
Right, except in American Ninja 3, apparently, Dudikoff is not available, so he's not in this one. Ninja 3 Blood Hunt. Dudikoff apparently comes back in for number 4.
Oh, so. Okay, so it's a Christopher Lambert, Adrian Paul Highlander situation.
Yes,
all right,
exactly.
Great. So you're giving me Adrian Paul Highlander. Thank you.
Well, I'm like I said, I've watched American Ninja and I've watched a little bit of American Ninja 2. And I will say that these are not totally repetitive and boring, and it's pretty entertaining. They're very dumb. But also there are like moments where it's like, did that ninja just fire a laser? What the fuck?
Franco Nero's not in these. He's in
Ninja? That's in Enter the Ninja.
Oh, okay. And that's the predecessor to Ninja 3, the Domination.
Right. I think the progression of those movies are Enter the Ninja, Revenge of the Ninja, then Ninja 3, the Domination.
Okay.
Revenge of the Ninja, I think, was shot in Utah. It was shot in Salt Lake City. So, fun fact.
All right. Well, American Ninja. American Ninja 3, Blood Hunt.
American Ninja 3, Blood Hunt.
Yep. All right. All right. It's come to this. Well, I guess we're at an action movie canon films bender, so we might as well just breathe deep. I'm down. I'm down for some more action cheese. I'm sure the worst case scenario is it's terribly boring, but yep. if it's any indicator so far, they're more dumb than boring, and that's all I can ask for in a bad movie.
Right, and it doesn't have the problematic elements that Death Wish 3 has. At least, like I said, I've only watched, you know, one and a half of these movies, so...
Well, if this third one is just fucking vile, we'll have words on the next episode.
We'll have words, yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, you know what? Death Wish 3, good times. That was easy. That was a breeze. We've had some brutal ones in the past, and that one, that was whatever. I took my medicine, and it was, I will apologize for nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, like we said, if you're looking for a dumb action movie... especially like an 80s style dumb action movie, it's kind of perfect. It's real dumb. It's got a bunch of like people that would become, it's got a few, oh, hey, it's that guy. Cause it's got Marina Sirtis. It's got Alex Winter. It's got, a couple Marines from Aliens are in it. the Cuban is Rico Ross, who is Frost in Aliens. The guy that looks like Denzel Washington.
Right.
Yeah. And then it's got Connell Cochran's son. So, you know, we have to kind of grandfather it in some way. So.
That's right. It's podcast part 3 royalty, I suppose.
Yes. until next time, where we will still be entrenched deep in the scuzzy underbelly of the 1980s, looking forward to it. Will, always a delight.
Always fun.
I don't know what you've set me up for, and I'm excited and I dread it at the same time, which is kind of sums up our relationship in a certain sense.
And all of these movies, all the American Ninja movies, are currently all free on Tubi. So.
Oh, give me that. free
probably
to
one of the best streaming services.
Oh, it's there's just so that is a cheese board if there ever was one. All right, Will. Until next time,
remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
Yeah, if you must. Oh boy,
always pleasure.
All right, I'm gonna go spray saline up my nose. But until next time, Will, always a delight. And folks, we will talk to you soon, and we'll 3 you later.
Bye.